It is Monday, November the 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, the campaign underway to retake Raqqa from the Islamic State.
Raqqa is a mostly Arab town and part of Syria, and it's outside of the traditional Kurdish areas. And this will certainly, if in fact this is what happens, will certainly put at ease various Arab allies of the U.S.-led coalition inside Syria.
It is almost election day here in the U.S. A new documentary about a sad day in the life of an American school, plus what's trending on social media. Hello everyone, I'm Steve Norman. Kurdish-led Syrian forces have begun an offensive to liberate the Islamic State's de facto capital of Raqqa, clashing with the extremists north of the Syrian city and warning neighboring Turkey not to interfere in the operation. The United States, France, and Britain have said that they will provide air support for the offensive, which was announced at a news conference by a coalition of Kurds and Arabs known as the Syria Democratic Forces. The announcement lacked details on how the group dominated by Kurds plans to oust the militants from the city, home to nearly 200,000 mostly Sunni Arabs and an estimated 5,000 Islamic State fighters. For some perspective on all of this, VOA's Victor Beatty asked Trinity University regional scholar David Lesh if the Take Back Raqqa mission came as a surprise to him.
I'm a little bit surprised because I thought the diplomatic complexities associated with this would take a little bit longer to work out. But apparently they have, or if they haven't, they'll soon come to light. But militarily, it makes sense to basically launch a pincer movement on the Islamic State from the east and the west, and the east in Mosul and the west, of course, in Raqqa. And this also, militarily speaking, I think prevents those in Mosul from escaping across the border into Syria, as well as those in Raqqa and Syria coming to the aid of fellow Islamic State fighters in Mosul. It also, I think, keeps them busy. ISIS has, of course, announced or called upon those outside of the area, or call on some of their followers inside the area to carry out attacks on cities and towns, not only outside of Syria and Iraq, but inside Syria and Iraq to try to divert forces. So I think by keeping the Islamic State busy on multiple fronts, they're less likely to do so.
You have two rebel opposition groups, the Free Syrian Army backed by Turkey, and of course the U.S. Backed Syrian Democratic Forces, of which the Kurds, the YPG Kurds, which Turkey considers terrorists, are a huge element. Is this going to provide a real problem?
It could. One assumes that all of this has been worked out between the United States and Turkey and their respective allies inside Syria, but we'll see. The Syrian Democratic Forces, which a large amount of whom are YPG, Kurdish YPG forces, opposed by the Turks, but supported by the U.S., they're the ones apparently that are carrying out the bulk of the attacks just outside of Raqqa. I'm not convinced this is a full assault of Raqqa. I think it's meant to again, keep the Islamic State fighting on two fronts, or at least thinking it has to fight on two fronts. And so if it's somewhat limited, because apparently they're still, about 30, 40 miles outside of Raqqa, which is where they've been for some time now, it's almost as if just by announcing that they're going to move on Raqqa, that will provide the strategic benefits of not actually having to do so. But at some point, they're going to have to move on Raqqa. So I think, my sense is that some of the diplomatic complexities, particularly between the SDF and the Free Syrian Army and their respective outside supporters, and negotiations, particularly between the U.S. and Turkey, still have to be worked out. And especially not only before and during any assault on Raqqa, but what comes in the aftermath.
David, the U.S. counter-Islamic State envoy Brett McGurk is in Jordan. He told reporters, among other things, the vanguard of the SDF forces entering Raqqa would be comprised of ethnic Arabs, not Kurdish fighters. Why?
Well, this is Raqqa is a mostly Arab town and part of Syria, and it's outside of the traditional Kurdish areas. And this will certainly, if in fact this is what happens, this will certainly put at ease various Arab allies of the U.S.-led coalition inside Syria, as well as perhaps the Syrian government and their Russian allies. And most particularly, they will satisfy the Turks. So if that is part of the deal, then that is maybe one concession made to the Turks. However, you know, most of the real fighting forces in the Syrian Democratic Forces are, in fact, Kurdish. So I don't know how they're going to reconcile that militarily in terms of moving into Raqqa, but just allowing, I guess, maybe officially the Arab portion of that force to liberate Raqqa, when in fact the Kurdish forces may do some of the heavy lifting.
David Lesh is a professor of Middle East history and politics at Trinity University. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
On Tuesday, November 8th, all eyes will be on America as voters choose the next U.S. president. Tune in to our live comprehensive coverage with our correspondents around the country and around the world, starting Tuesday at 2200 hours UTC GMT and continuing through Wednesday morning right here on VOA.
Do you love music from Africa and the world? VOA has the latest hits, interviews with the artists, and we are glad to take your requests. The Voice of America has what you're looking for. We have music shows to please everyone. Join us on the radio or on the internet to listen day or night. Go to voanews.com and voaafrica.com and click on your favorite program. Just follow your ears. Music from Africa and the world. We've got it on VOA.
This is VOA's International Edition. Well, just one day before the U.S. presidential election and the candidates of the two major parties are crisscrossing the country, campaigning almost nonstop, Democrat Hillary Clinton and Republican Donald Trump making the final push to get voters to support them.
Are you ready to vote on November the 8th?
And we are going to win back the White House. It's going to happen.
For more on the presidential campaigning, my colleague Jim Stevenson speaks with VOA correspondent Michael Bowman about it all.
This is indeed the final furious chapter of an election process that really began a year ago.
Oh, I mean, it feels like it.
Presidents serve for four-year terms, but really the presidential campaign cycle is about a year long. It's in the fall of the previous year when all the candidates announce. For some, I suppose it's excruciatingly long. For political junkies, maybe it's just long enough. But I suspect that many people will go to the polls on Tuesday, cast their votes, and be glad that this particular cycle is coming to an end.
Unlike in many other countries, this is a particularly long cycle. And you really do get a sense, I guess, through this of what the candidates are like, their personalities. We've seen both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump go off in many different directions over this period of time.
We have. And it's interesting to look at the polling data of the last few weeks. There was the revelation from the FBI that they were looking into a new batch of emails, and the polls very much tightened last week. There's new polling data out in the last 24 hours that suggests that Clinton may have recovered a little bit of the lead that she had before. But we're still talking 4 points in an NBC poll, 5 points in an ABC poll. And that's still within a margin where if one candidate outperforms in terms of turnout or underperforms in terms of turnout, where the election could still be decided. This is not in the bag for Hillary Clinton by any means. But when you look at the map, there are certain things that have not changed. There are states that Hillary Clinton can afford to lose, toss-up states, battleground states, that Donald Trump simply cannot afford to lose. If you look at the math, it's almost impossible to see him clawing his way to victory if he doesn't win Florida. Hillary Clinton could lose Florida and still win the Electoral College. It's hard to see how Donald Trump claws his way to an Electoral College victory without North Carolina. So from Hillary Clinton's perspective, you could lose either of the either of those states, win one of them, and essentially her path is pretty much a sure thing. The way that I look at it is, imagine with all these battleground states, the challenge for Trump is to toss heads six times in a row. That's possible. Mm-hmm. Randomly, you could toss a coin and get heads six times in a row. But if one of those goes tails and one of those states goes to Clinton, then her path to the electoral votes, the electoral college votes, is looking very bright indeed.
Yeah, we talk about 4 percentage points, but these are nationwide polls, and Al Gore in 2000 will tell you the popular vote doesn't mean anything in that sense. And the math just doesn't seem to add up for Donald Trump at this point. I've seen several electoral maps out there that said, oh, here's a possible way he could do it, this, that, or the other. But as you point out, one state pretty much will sink his chances.
That's true. I would say that there is one wild card, and I wouldn't have given much credence to it except for the actions of the Clinton campaign in the last 24 hours. They have scheduled a visit to Michigan in the waning hours of the campaign. Why they would do that, why they would suddenly be concerned about Michigan, which is pretty much as blue an upper mm-hmm. Midwest state mm-hmm. as they get, it almost lends credence to the idea coming from the Trump campaign that there is a hidden working class white vote for Trump that is just waiting to come out and vote for him. I don't know that that's the case, but arguably, if Trump wins, say, Ohio, and were to pick off one of the states that everyone assumed was safe for Clinton, whether it's Michigan, whether it's Wisconsin, mm-hmm. either of those states, then all of a sudden Donald Trump's possibilities grow to a certain degree. I think that your average betting person would be well advised to place their bets on Hillary Clinton. But look at the year that we've had. Look at all the unbelievable things that have come to pass. Look at all the polls that have been wrong in so many states and so many instances. I don't think that any person who puts out poll data is entirely confident of what the numbers are suggesting.
That's Michael Bowman. He is the VOA Senate correspondent, and he was speaking with International Edition's Jim Stevenson. By the way, Jim and our colleague Lori London will be hosting VOA's coverage of the election results beginning at 0 hour Universal Time Wednesday. And now we turn our attention to Russia and the factor it might be in the U.S. election. It has been alleged that Russia-backed hackers infiltrated the computer system of the U.S. Democratic Party headquarters, as well as obtaining emails from Hillary Clinton's campaign chief, John Podesta, and turning those over to WikiLeaks. For some perspective, VOA's Carol Castiel speaks with Jeffrey Mankoff, deputy director and senior fellow with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and Ilya Zaslavsky, a visiting senior fellow at the Legatum Institute. Carol asked Mankoff about the level of concern he might have regarding possible Russian involvement in the U.S. election.
I think the likelihood of there being some kind of additional malfeasance with cyber attacks or more broadly efforts to influence the outcome of the elections in the United States are certainly possible. Whether they are likely or not is very hard to say. I don't think we entirely understand the Russian political calculation here. I think what we've seen over the last several months is that, one, Russia has some fairly sophisticated technical capabilities, but also a willingness, as you said, that we haven't really seen before to try and directly influence the domestic political process in the United States. And because we haven't seen that before, I think the U.S. government is struggling to come up with a response. It's trying to balance being open about what's happening with protecting intelligence sources and methods. It's trying to balance pushing back against what is a serious escalation in terms of Russian tactics with the desire not to get caught in some kind of an escalatory spiral, either in the cyber domain or more broadly. In a lot of ways, we're in uncharted territory here. And I think until after the presidential election in the United States, it's going to be difficult for the U.S. government, for the Obama administration, to do anything very decisive about it because of the delicate political situation in this country.
Turning to you, Ilya Zaslavsky, for your take on this. As Jeff said, it seems like we are in uncharted territory. Cyber espionage is not new, but this leaking of the documents through WikiLeaks, making it public, perhaps some of them are even doctored. How concerned are you as we approach Election Day that Russia may continue these sophisticated cyber assaults, if not to necessarily throw the election in one direction or another, but just to cause panic, to undermine confidence in our democratic system?
I'm pretty sure they will continue doing it, and they have already done it with other countries, with Estonia, and these hacks have continued around the world. And only now they got this really global attention because of U.S. elections, but it wasn't news for many East European countries. Reportedly, Condoleezza Rice, when she was state secretary, she didn't use email much because of such concerns. And I actually think we have entered a new era of sort of state-level hacking at highest levels. And maybe that's likely to lead actually to more instances of high-level officials not using electronic devices and emails at all, or using them very carefully. As for the specific threats during these elections, I think undoubtedly Russians will try to present elections as rigged. How massively they will interfere, I don't know, but the propaganda is already working on this issue and working it up.
Even if Donald Trump wins?
I would say that they sort of treat these two matters differently. Trump may be a good thing and his victory is sort of one separate issue, but that democracy is as corrupt and rotten as everybody else in the U.S., that's been an issue they've been peddling for many years now.
Ilya Zaslavsky is a visiting senior fellow at the Legatum Institute. He and Jeffrey Mankoff, deputy director and senior fellow at the Center for Strategics and International Studies. We're speaking with Carol Castiel. She is host of our program, Encounter. You can hear more of their conversation by going to our website, voanews.com, and look for Encounter.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military.
You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
and
civilians.
Sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians.
With all that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
And now it's time to see what's trending on social media. Our social media expert, G. Abby Lee, is here. What you got, G?
Hi, Steve. It's a love story involving three penguins. And if you thought it's going to be a cute one, I hate to disappoint you because it's tragic, it's jarring, and also bloody. National Geographic posted a short clip of a penguin fight on its Twitter, and it sent people into a frenzy. The encounter is very jarring, but the reason for the fight is even more so.
And why is that, G?
Over the course of just under 3 minutes, a clip describes the love triangle between a husband, his wife, and a homewrecker. The two male penguins fight for a bid after the husband finds his wife with a new guy, and then the two call on the wife to decide on who she wants to be with. And when she chooses a homewrecker, that's when the fight really intensifies. The husband follows a new couple into their new home, and I'm not going to describe all the gory details, but there's use of the wings and the beaks.
Okay, I guess that's enough of the penguin drama. What else is trending out there?
The 40th annual New York City Marathon. Runners from all over the world gave it their all to compete in the event that encompasses five boroughs. people are also talking about the daylight saving time.
Oh, yep, of course. Just to explain briefly, it's the practice in the U.S. of setting the clock forward by 1 hour during the warmer part of the year so that evenings have more daylight and mornings have less.
That's right. North Americans woke up on Sunday with an extra hour on the clock thanks to the end of daylight saving time. And in case you forgot, some people are better at change than others. Here's a tweet that captures what happens on the first Sunday after daylight saving ends. Here's all the people who will be at the church 50 minutes early instead of 10 minutes late today. Hashtag daylight saving time. Steve, back to you.
It always affects the schedules, but we make it happen. Hey, listen, thanks, G. International Edition's G. Abby Lee. By the way, you can follow G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And our program, International Edition, is on Twitter at VOA _IE. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Among the most mysterious objects in the universe are Lyman Alpha Blobs, or LAB. A LAB has been described as a huge cloud of hydrogen gas in distant areas of space. Since its discovery in 2000, scientists have been stumped by what causes a LAB to shine so brightly. Studying one of the largest objects found so far, a team of astronomers say they found two galaxies at the object's core that are forming stars at a rate over 100 times that of the Milky Way. Surrounding these two prolific galaxies is a swarm of smaller galaxies, which the team says appears to be an early phase in the formation of a massive galaxy cluster. It's thought all the star-making activity may be producing the UV light that illuminates the surrounding cloud of hydrogen gas. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. You know, it's been nearly 4 years since 20 children and 6 educators were gunned down at Sandy Hook Elementary School. That's in the U.S. city of Newtown, Connecticut. VOA's David Byrd tells us about Newtown, a new documentary that looks at the effect the massacre had on that town and on the country.
John, 911, what's the location of your emergency?
Sandy Hook Elementary School, 12 Dickinson Drive.
Okay, what's going on down there?
I believe there's shooting at the front glass. Something's going on.
I want you to take cover. Jen, get everybody you can going down there.
It's still happening.
The film opens with the horrified voices of people calling 911 to report the shootings at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. The new documentary, Newtown, uses first-person interviews with some of the victims' families, neighbors, and co-workers to tell the story. Mark Barden's son, Daniel, was one of those killed.
I still have a little secrets stashed around. He used to wear this old yellow football helmet when he'd ride in the little seat in the back of my bicycle. And I have that in the garage, and it still has some beautiful little long blonde hairs of his in it.
In one scene, Nicole Hockley, whose son Dylan was also shot, shows a room stacked with boxes of condolence cards, gifts, and other items from well-wishers.
This is most of the stuff that's been, I don't even know how many thousands of letters and gifts and portraits.
So many of them have never been opened because I just can't do that yet.
Kim Snyder, who also directed Welcome to Shelbyville about Somali refugee immigrants in small-town America, is Newtown's director.
And we felt we had not seen a film like this that had really looked at the trajectory of up to 3 years. We filmed over the course of 3 years. Sadly, there's been so many since. But I think Newtown, for so many people, was a watershed moment and really needed to be, you know, we needed to bear witness to that so that with the hope that that something could change.
Maria Cuomo Cole is the film's producer. She says that the filmmakers wanted to remain sensitive to the pain community members were in, but also wanted to highlight the bravery and endurance shown by Newtown.
Kim and I felt it was extremely important to be as sensitive as possible, of course, in telling this important story, a story that, you know, we don't have the luxury to forget in America. It's hard stuff, but it's part of who we are. And hopefully, you know, we can learn from it and create change to keep communities safe.
Do you promise to live life to its fullest?
I do!
Do you promise to cherish family and friends?
I do!
The film takes a hopeful turn when it shows community members taking part in the Daniel Barden Mudfest, an endurance race that benefits several charities. Nicole Hockley has also been able to go into the room of condolence gifts and to start opening some of them. The issue of gun control has been hotly debated in this year's presidential campaign. Maria Cuomo said her hope is that Newtown will touch people's hearts on both sides of the issue and will result in change. That change has still not arrived. Earlier this year, the deadliest massacre in modern U.S. history took place in Orlando, with 49 people gunned down at a nightclub. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
And many thanks to you, Dave. Couple of more stories for you. A country singer, Kenny Chesney, wants Beyoncé fans to know they got it all wrong. He loves Beyoncé. Some viewers watching the 50th Annual Country Music Association Awards last week targeted the country star for his facial expression during Beyoncé's performance with the group The Dixie Chicks. Many fans said online that he didn't appear to be very impressed with one of the, what they call, biggest performances of the evening. Many Broadway shows in New York are planning not to compete with the U.S. presidential election this week. Among those shows taking the night off are Beautiful, that's the Carole King musical, Cats, Chicago, and the Phantom of the Opera. There are many more. The actual opera in New York, the Metropolitan Opera and Carnegie Hall, will also be dark. The move is to both encourage, they say, voting and to avoid competing with that nail-biting decision by the end of the night. Some plays will be having a normal presentation. How about that, huh? Good for them. Hey, listen, thanks for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you here. The latest world news is straight ahead. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman. We're all here in Washington, and we're hoping you have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
When it comes to humanitarian aid, one of the greatest achievements of the past quarter century is the fact that since the early 1990s, the number of undernourished people who live in the developing world has dropped by just short of half, from 23.3% to 12.9%. But the improvement, though impressive, has been uneven, with great regional differences. In fact, some areas, many of them suffering from overpopulation, conflict, or deep, inequitable economic growth, have actually gotten worse. So, in developing the Office of Food for Peace's Food Assistance and Food Security Strategy for the next decade, the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, incorporated the lessons it has learned from the successes and even failures of the past 25 years. One of the more successful ways food assistance programs can tackle chronic hunger and poverty is by looking beyond food, wrote Dina Esposito, director of USAID's Office of Food for Peace, in a recent blog post. This means looking at food security from all angles and asking the right questions, such as how did families earn incomes to put food on the table? How much food did families produce on their land, only enough to feed their families? Or were they able to sell crops too? What were the causes of malnutrition in the communities? The primary goal of the 2016 to 2025 plan is to improve and sustain food and nutrition security in vulnerable populations. USAID's Office of Food for Peace is working to achieve that goal through a two-pronged approach. One works to meet immediate needs and strengthen capacities that protect and enhance lives and livelihoods. The other works to strengthen local systems for longer-term sustainability in key areas impacting food security. There is unprecedented consensus that building the resilience of vulnerable communities, including their food and nutrition security, is key to our larger goals of ending extreme poverty, enhancing stability, and spurring economic growth, wrote Director Esposito. Through the development of the new strategy, we reaffirm our shared vision of a world free of hunger and poverty, where all people live in dignity, peace, and security, and together set out an ambitious goal for the next decade to improve and sustain the food and nutrition security of vulnerable populations.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.